Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, August 5th. Today's session is Nurturing the Moral and Spiritual Lives of Children, Exposing Children to Good Examples, and Participating in Family Service Projects, presented by Marsha Bungie. The number of the tape is 2002-06. Let's listen in.
Christ College, the Adams College, and I have a very great interest in the moral and spiritual development of children for a lot of reasons. One, we have two children of our own, a nine-year-old and a newly adopted one-and-a-half-year-old. I also teach at a church-related college, and we're always talking about the whole person, nurturing the spiritual and moral lives, and the academic intellectual lives of our students, and so you think a lot about how students, what has happened before they came to college and what's going on as they are in your classes. And I'm also interested in children because I'm disturbed, as probably many of you are, about a lot of the struggles children are facing in our country and around the world. I think concern for children is growing across conservative and liberal lines for a lot of reasons, because there are so many challenges that children in our country are facing. Just a few: inadequate child care and educational opportunities for all children. It's so uneven in our country, some of these opportunities. The continued high rate of teenage pregnancy, even though that's gone down, still 1 in 8 children is born to a teenager. Juvenile crime, people are concerned about that. High rates of teenage depression and suicide, child neglect and abuse, and the high rates of poverty, of child poverty in our country, which has gone down again, but is still 16%, so 1 in 6 children approximately is living in poverty. Now, even some students at my universities, most of them come from very privileged backgrounds, really struggle with some serious problems, such as addiction to alcohol and drugs, or depression, lack of sexual boundaries, or a kind of sense of lack of purpose and meaning in their life. So I see that even among my very gifted, highly privileged young people in my classes. So whether or not we are parents ourselves, I think we're concerned about children in our midst and in our wider culture. And we're asking questions like, are they being raised with love and affection? Are they receiving a good education? Are they exposed to good role models? Will they have a sense of meaning and purpose in their lives? Will they be able to contribute something positive to society? And I think in the church we're also asking, will these young people have a strong, active faith that can carry them through difficulties and joys in life, and also really empower them to get out there and to love and serve others? And I think as we ask questions about children, we're also concerned about the parents in our midst trying to raise these children, because a lot of them are also facing tremendous challenges. We think about the time bind a lot of parents have. They don't have the kind of flexible schedules they need to take care of their children. Or we think about the working poor who not only have inflexible schedules, they don't have enough money really, even though they're working one or two jobs to pay for the basic needs of their children. Or we live in a culture too that's very individualistic, focused on self-fulfillment, and that kind of undermines a sense of parental responsibility, a sense of civic responsibility to children. Or even parents who say we're trying to do the best they can, they struggle with a lot of the forces in our culture, or in the media, or in television, or popular culture, that seem to undermine the values that they're trying to teach their children. And I really don't think that we're doing enough, even though we certainly care about children and parents in the church. We're not doing enough for them. And we don't have the kind of rich social teaching, for example, about children and parents, like we do about other issues. We don't have a strong line of teaching about who are children, what are they, what are our obligations to them, not just parents, but the community, the church, the state. We have a lot more elaborate teachings about things like abortion, about contraception, about things that happen before you have the kid, or about sexuality. But then once you have the child, there just isn't enough conversation and discussion, I don't think, in the church about our serious obligations to children. And I think a lot of parents who want to work in the church struggle too with How can they coordinate what's going on in the home and in the church, and then pastors also get somewhat frustrated when parents sometimes drop their children off at the church, sort of expecting, now you take care of the spiritual nurture and we'll be back after Sunday school here. And there's not enough of this rich interaction between what's going on in the home and in the church. So a lot of parents are really not talking to their children about moral and spiritual matters. And I gave one statistic on Saturday that in one study of 8,000 adolescents whose parents were members of congregations of different, it's 11 different Catholic and Protestant denominations, only 10% of the families discussed faith or moral matters with any degree of regularity, just 10%. And 43% of the families never discussed faith issues. 43%, so there's something going on. It's like maybe if you even had the best program in the world at your church, but nothing went on then in the home, how do we expect young people to appropriate our values, our concerns, if we're not talking to them and doing some practices in the home that really support what's going on in the church? What I want to do this week is focus on nurturing the moral and spiritual life of children. And in general, I'll be talking about very specific attitudes, responsibilities, and practices that we can do either as parents or people who care about children to help nurture the moral and spiritual lives of children. So we'll be addressing some broad questions. What are some of your own concerns about children and families today? What are some of the best ways you see to nurture the moral and spiritual lives of children? We also need to talk about what are some of the obstacles we see in our families, in our religious communities, in our culture, and in our country to attending to the needs of children and helping to protect and nurture them. And how can we all work together more diligently and passionately to protect and nurture the children in our midst? So those are kind of the broad questions. And then I want to be talking and focusing each day on a couple suggestions, some practical suggestions for nurturing children. And I'll be discussing then over the next 4 days, 8 concrete ways that we find in the Christian tradition for helping nurture the moral and spiritual lives of children. And these are primarily in the home by the parents, but also in other settings by other adults who care very much about children. I think we have to say we need to focus on what's going on in the home, because the parents are the primary moral and spiritual agents. They're the ones, you know, most in contact with the children. If something's not going on in the home, again, even if you have the best programs outside of it, they might not work as well as if you have some cooperation in the home. So these are things primarily for parents in the home, but children also need, as many studies show us, many caring adults, people who care about them, love them, know them, want to nurture them. And so I think it's important that we all think about ways, whether or not we have children of our own, for nurturing the children in our midst. So these are some sort of 8 concrete ways that I was working on a book last year, The Child and Christian Thought, looking at ways we've perceived children in the history of Christianity. And there are some sad chapters in this history, some brutal chapters, some very embarrassing chapters about how we've treated children and thought about them. But there was always also some very rich resources here. And so some of what I'm saying comes out of this work, looking at the past and what has helped in the past, what have theologians, philosophers said about how best to nurture children. So I'm taking some of that from the tradition, but also a lot of what I say is confirmed by sociological studies or psychological studies about children. So I'll just pass this out. I put together some of the questions I'll be addressing. People will be coming to just, you know, not all of them, but I thought I'd put down the 8 central ways of nurturing the moral and spiritual lives of children. And some questions. So if you see, here they are, session 1. If you just start session 1, the third sort of major section down, we'll be talking about exposing children to good examples and participating in service projects today. then talking about reading and discussing the Bible and interpretations of it with children. Is it worth doing? Why should you do it? How can you do it? And carrying out family rituals and traditions of worship, prayer, and service. And the importance of rituals, not only family rituals, but community rituals for children. And then the next session is on training children in music. That's kind of a neglected theme in discussions about nurturing children today, that music is a very powerful force for young people, I think for all of us. And so I want to reflect on the importance of music in nurturing children and appreciating the natural world and cultivating a reverence for creation. And then 7 and 8, educating children and helping them discern their vocation and learning from children. And then the last session is a more broad discussion about what more the church could do to help parents, especially as they try their best to nurture their children. So I want to say, too, as we discuss these suggestions, and I'm very anxious to hear about your own suggestions, what you have found to be helpful in your own life or in the lives of children in your midst. But I thought it's important to keep something in mind, and I put that in sort of the second paragraph there on this sheet, that we spent a lot of time last week talking about some of the ways we perceive children. I did a session on vocation of parenting. And although we sometimes think of children in very narrow ways, we talked about sometimes we see them as commodities, our kind of property, or consumers, that's a big issue today, when they have so much buying power, or as economic burdens. We don't care about other children, and they cost too much money. Or we sometimes think of them as, you know, these pure, innocent little babies and young children. But then when you start talking about teenagers, you get these sort of dark, evil creatures lurking around. If you look at magazine covers, I think it's always so revealing how we depict teenagers, you know. Or as kind of on their way to becoming human. They're nice, they're cute, but they're not quite human. They're on their way there, and we got to help them out. And I think it's nice to keep in mind that the Bible and the Christian tradition and the Christian theologians haven't kept this in mind themselves as well as they should have, that the Bible depicts children in very rich ways as gifts of God and sources of joy, as certainly sinful creatures, moral agents. They have the capacity, they have responsibilities and the capacity to do right and wrong. They're developing beings in need of instruction. They're made in the image of God, so they are fully human, not on their way to being human, but fully human, and they are worthy of dignity and respect. And we need to address their needs. They are also, and this is so surprising, I have a little handout if you'd like to look at it more, but that they are also seen as moral witnesses to adults. What adult behavior? They are kind of witnessing how we are acting. And in the Gospels, you see this strong message of children as models of faith and even sources of revelation. A very surprising kind of theme in that time, but even in our own time. I don't think we always think about adults learning from children, that they reveal things to us. But that's another important thing. And then also, they are depicted certainly as orphans, neighbors, and strangers who need to be treated justly and with compassion. And I just wanted to lift this up because I think together, this kind of richer picture, and I think there's certainly more we could say even about children, but this richer picture helps combat some of the narrow views of children we have in our culture, and I think even in the church, and can empower maybe us all to learn more from children and to work more diligently to protect and to nurture them. So that's kind of a presupposition to what I have to say, something to keep in mind. And now I'll focus. I would like to just give a few remarks about my thoughts about the importance of good examples in the lives of children, but you can certainly chime in at any time, and a few thoughts about what does it mean to do, why is it so important that families together do service projects, not just having the young people going off and volunteering, but that young people are doing service projects, going out there and serving others with caring adults and with their parents, and why is that so important. And then we'll have plenty of time for discussion about these two suggestions here. But feel free again to chime in anytime with your own thoughts. I think everybody does certainly recognize the importance of good examples in the lives of children. Examples help children see how someone is contributing concretely to the common good and living out a life of meaning and purpose. Examples give young people concrete possibilities for thinking and acting in positive and life-giving ways. They give children a sense that one person's life can make a difference, including their own. One of the favorite things we have at Christ College is when alumni come back, and we have a kind of a panel, and they talk about work, faith, and love. And some of them were history majors, and they became CEOs of some computer company. Some of them, you know, had such a different life journey than they thought they would take, but it's a very powerful panel because I think young people like to see, well, how are you really living this out? How are you putting together your faith, your commitments to your community, and your commitments to your family together? And that's one of the most powerful panels we have in our university. Robert Coles, who's done so much work on the moral and spiritual lives of children, he teaches at Harvard, expresses the powerful effect of examples in the development of children in this way, and I'll just read one longer quote. The most persuasive moral teaching we as adults do is by example. The witnesses of our lives, our ways of being with others and speaking to them and getting on with them, all of that taken in slowly, cumulatively by our sons and daughters and our students. To be sure, other sources can count a great deal. Formal lectures, explicit talks, reading and more reading and discussions of what has been read, reprimands and reminders with punishment of various kinds, church going and synagogue attendance, the experience of hearing sermons and being told about biblical messages, the moral lessons and the wisdom of our secular novelists, poets, and playwrights. All of these things count a great deal. But in the long run of a child's life, the unself-conscious moments that are what we think of simply as the unfolding events of the day and the week, they turn out to be the really powerful and persuasive times for children morally. I think we'd all agree with that, and certainly in the Christian tradition, if we talk about who is a good example, we talk about those kinds of people who are living out their convictions, who are certainly articulate about what they believe, but they also strive to live out their beliefs in concrete acts of service. Good examples are engaged in life, engaged in seeking to live out what they believe and confess. They are engaged in loving and serving others. They work for peace and justice in whatever settings they find themselves. And good examples, I think we don't always think of this, but good examples also know they're not alone. They're not alone in life, and they nurture their close friendships. They seek help and support of others. I think that's very important to show children today, too, that a good example knows that they need some help at times. Furthermore, since no human being is perfect, good examples also take time for self-examination. They might recognize their limitations. They can admit wrongdoing, and they can ask for forgiveness and healing. I think we need to foster that kind of example for young people, too. Robert Coles has emphasized the importance of role models in the lives of children. And one other thing I found so interesting in his work, he talked so much about the danger of adult hypocrites for young people, that young people are very attuned to people who do not live out their convictions. And in one of the striking themes that's repeated over and over, if you look at his work, is how children recognize and are disturbed by hypocrisy, and they are aware of adult hypocrisy. And he believes that also for young people leads to this kind of cynicism we see at young people. You know, they're not even 18 years old, and they're already, some of them, very cynical and very self-centered. So he believes a lot of that hypocrisy leads to that kind of attitude among young people. He has one story about some young people in a high school who became involved in drugs and alcohol, for example. And he talked a lot to these young people, spent a lot of time with them. And they certainly had a lot of peers in their midst who were their examples, and they were following them. But the young people were also aware of a lot of parents and school authorities who had told them to walk the straight and narrow path, but they knew, for example, that some of these school authorities and parents were having affairs, for example. They were also struggling with their own alcohol addiction or drug addiction. And Cole says that their awareness of adult hypocrisy became, for a lot of them, almost a justification for their own wrongdoing. So that has been very helpful for me, to just think about this, the power of hypocrisy in the lives of young people. The Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh also has spoken very eloquently about the importance of examples, and he talks a lot. He encourages young people to go back to their own tradition. He says a lot of our young people are uprooted spiritually. They don't have a sense of meaning. And he encourages them to go back to their own tradition. He's not encouraging them all to become Buddhists. But one thing he says, why are these young people so uprooted? Why do they have such a lack of purpose? And one thing he thinks is that they don't see enough adults embodying their tradition. That they don't see enough of not just their parents, but other adults in their midst embodying the values that they're talking about. So parents can be good examples to their children in many ways, and we'll talk about that. How they can be good examples in the home, in the church, and in their wider community. I think it's really important to not only to live out this example, but also to just talk about some of your struggles and to discuss your values and life struggles with your children or with children you care about. This Bob Benny, I mentioned him once before, he wrote a very poignant piece in the Crescent. We get this journal here, about how he was an example. He wanted to be an example to his children, but he regretted very much that he didn't talk enough with his children about why he did what he did. And so his children came away not knowing always what was important to him, and he regrets that. So, and kind of wrote it as a warning to other people raising young people. Parents, I think the power of stories is also very important to keep in mind, that if you tell stories about your own life, how you came to do what you do, why you have the values you do, or the stories of people you really admire yourself. Reading stories or talking about people of faith who have informed your own life. And these can certainly be examples that are well known in our culture, or are examples from the past, or from one's own life experience. Many Christians, as well as non-Christians, have been moved and transformed by the powerful witness of Christians in the 20th century who lived out their lives with a sense of purpose, such as Dorothy Day, or Martin Luther King, Mother Teresa, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And I think talking about that, telling these stories to children, is very important. Many particular Christian traditions also hold up examples of those who are important in their particular tradition. I have friends who are Mennonites. They talk about Mena Simons. They talk about the martyrs in their tradition. And they tell those stories again and again to their children as a way to talk about how they value these kinds of lives and what they value in them. We all have stories of mentors who've been important to us, maybe an aunt or uncle, maybe a coach, and telling those kinds of stories too is important to young people. A lot of studies tell us too that it's very important that young people have not only their parents as examples, but a lot of other caring adults in their midst as examples. People who really care about these young people, who know them, who are interested in their lives, who want to talk to them. And so finding these other mentors in your children's lives is also important. Let me just say a couple things about then loving and serving the neighbor as a family, and why these service projects as a family or as a community are so powerful for young people. Because certainly one of the most important ways to be an example to young people is to do a kind of, carry out a service project, a project with young people that serves the neighbor and shows compassion for others. I think this is especially important for families today. We can certainly do that as a community, but it's important for families, for children with their parents, to carry out these kinds of service projects. I think it's important because parents need to help their children understand that their family is just not watching out just for its own, but that it is a family that is reaching out to others, that is concerned about the poor and marginalized, and that's part of our identity as a family, not just looking out for our own. There's a very nice book by Lisa Cahill, who's talked a lot about families. She has a book on the Christian family. And she talks about how serving the others as a family really is very important to thinking about what a Christian family means. So often when we talk about what's a Christian family, we say, well, you have a committed marriage, or you help your children have a good education, or you have good spousal relationships. That's what's going on in a family. But throughout her book, she emphasizes that a Christian family must also be a vehicle of social justice, that you should think of your family as a vehicle of social justice. She reminds families they're called not only to nurture and sustain their own members, but also to care for other persons and families, especially the least well-off in society, and to transform unjust social and economic structures. So this is what she says, the quote, the Christian family is not the nuclear family, focused inward on the welfare of its own members, but the Christian family is a socially transformative family that seeks to make the Christian moral ideal of love the neighbor part of the common good. So really seeing your family more as a family that reaches out to others, she thinks is really central, and you have to cultivate that intentionally in your family. The foundation for Cahill's understanding of the family is clearly built on the Gospels and Jesus' message of the kingdom of God. Jesus' preaching of the reign of God invokes an inclusive community that's united in Christ and united in love and service to the neighbor. So within this community, this kind of loyalty we have to the family hierarchy and to our family is superseded by a solidarity and a loyalty to other believers and to those in need of all class standings. For Cahill, the implication of this vision for Christian families is that they are to form members, you're supposed to have a kind of ethos of mutuality, equality, and solidarity, and at the same time always subsume this kind of family loyalty, this kin loyalty, under compassion for the neighbor, the stranger, and the enemy as those belonging to one's family in Christ. And she talks about how helping, being a family like that doesn't mean you just do certain social service projects in your community, but that you also criticize unjust economic structures and unjust social structures. So I have appreciated her book very much. And she emphasizes that Christian families should reach out to with compassion to all forms of families, whatever structure they are. That sometimes you want to reach out to only the families that look like you. If you're a two-parent family or a single-parent family, you're going to reach out to those, but that we need to reach out to all forms of families. And the Black community is certainly a model for us in that way. There's a kind of sense we need to do certain things for the family, but there's a very strong message of forgiveness and openness and love and helping all families. I think that's one thing that's very good too about conservative and evangelical churches. They recognize families are broken, that they have some needs, and that we all need to reach out there and help them. And they have some tremendous programs for, single parents, what can we do for you concretely? Not just offer a kind of class about parenting, but what can we do to help you get to work on time? What can we do to help you with your kids? So in that sense, they can be a model to mainline Christian churches who are a little more reluctant to talk about family needs. We can talk a lot about people's illnesses. And people talk about how in the service there's always this organ recital where you talk about, someone's got the liver problem, someone's got the, heart problem, and that we feel open to talk about those issues, but not so much about problems in our family or in our community in terms of familial relationships. Working together on service projects or on legislation that helps the poor are powerful ways for families to embody a Christian understanding of family responsibility that doesn't just include marital commitment or education of children, but also social action and concern for those outside one's own immediate family. They give children a kind of hands-on idea of what we mean when we say we care about others. These activities help them start to imagine a larger range of possibilities for showing love to others, for civic involvement, and for contributing to the kind of to the common good. I have a little bibliography here I can give to you at the end, but there's one book on there, Passing on the Faith by Hardell and Strumman. And they've talked about, they were shocked when they started doing all these surveys of young people, how powerful these service projects are, especially if adults talk to young people during or after this event or some, you know, way you've served others, but talk to them about what it means to them and what it has meant to the children. And he has a study, and one study, they found that, and you kind of can't hardly believe it, but this is what they found in a very large study, that involvement in service, these kinds of service projects we're talking about, with caring adults, proved to be a better predictor of faith maturity than participation in Sunday school, Bible study, or worship services. And that when young people talked about what most helped them in the last year to develop their faith or help them know about their values, many of them mentioned it was some kind of project they did with other caring adults for the community. So those are some ideas I have, and I'd like to hear your thoughts. I put some questions down on this section to hear your thoughts about these two suggestions. And I want to close with just saying I think it's very helpful, too, if you talk about families. We need a richer language to say, what is the purpose and nature of a family? That we do have this kind of sense, we're watching out for our own. If you do a good job, and it was your choice to have kids, and okay, you do a good job with your own little family, that's enough. But we need a broader vision about what the family is about. And there is this notion of the family as a little church, or the family as a domestic church, that we see again and again in the tradition. And that doesn't mean just that the family should worship together, they should educate, they should pray together. Certainly it means those things. But when we talk about the family as a little church, people like Chrysostom in the 4th century or Bushnell in the 19th century, who use this term and like to talk about the family as the domestic church or little church, also mean, like the church, the family reaches out to the poor and marginalized. That's part of its task, that's part of its central identity. And families are all trying to find ways to connect, to shape a sense of identity. It's very important for young people. And I think it helps if we find a richer kind of spiritual language to talk about what is a family. How do we think of ourselves as a family? And so I'd like to hear your suggestions about that too. So what are your thoughts about these two themes, or other concerns you have about children? So it doesn't have to be narrow to that.
I'm curious about why the service projects rated so much higher than just, and I don't know if it's because the service projects were sort of like a summer trip. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things I struggle with is that, you know, our kids go in the parish, go on these summer trips, mm-hmm. which, you know, often include also, you know, Virginia Beach and, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? And okay, we spent a day helping some people, but some of it was just the getting away that becomes large for them as they remember their summer, mm-hmm. As opposed to the, for lack of a better word, the weekly grind of just the community worshiping together seems rather boring and dull, perhaps. I don't know. I'm just curious about that as to why that is.
Yeah.
But obviously it made a big impression.
It did.
And it does on our kids, too.
Yeah. So, or I think about our college classes. I've taken a number of students to Germany to do a course on the Lutheran tradition. I've taught the Lutheran tradition over 10 years. But I've done this trip now 3 times. We go to Wittenberg, we go to Eisenach, Leipzig, and we travel 2 or 3 weeks together. And I always get, you know, the best evaluation. And they remember this, they write back about it. It was so life-shaping, these kinds of trips. And I think it's partly because you are in this sort of extended daily conversation with young people. It's not just, okay, let's sit down, we read this book together, what do you think? But it's more, you know, you're buying the sandwiches, you're kind of in this daily daily grind with them, and they see how you're living it out and talking casually to them. There's one college I want to mention, just Goshen College. They do a tremendous program. You can't believe they can do it, but every student there is required to spend a semester abroad. But they don't just spend it in the Bahamas or, in some ritzy hotel in Florence. What they do is they always go to poor communities, Central and South America. They have programs in China. They have programs in Africa. And students are required to go there for one semester of their college education. And they're required to go with a professor. So all these professors do. Every professor also has to spend some time abroad with these young people for this semester abroad, where you're learning about the culture, but you're also doing concrete acts of service to the poor in these poor communities. And they have this tradition where they get up and give testimonies about what happened during their year, and all of them. I mean, it's not just getting away, it's partly getting away, and you kind of see your life in a different way. Just, gosh, if you spend a few weeks in another country, you always start thinking, why do we do it that way instead of the way we do it at home? So it's partly that, but it's partly, it's the most transforming thing about their college experience for most of those students. What other ideas people have about why that's so important?
Well, I'm a student at the university, and but I still remember the first time I went on a mission trip, and it was definitely I really just got to know people, apart from going to church every Sunday. And I grew up in a divorced family, so I wasn't really involved with the church because I'd just be at my dad's house every other weekend. But it was just, it's not always going to be that way for all students, because I remember another year I went and a large part of the group was more kind of a partier type, and it really bothered me because they weren't really focused on the reason that we were there. But I think wherever you go, if the pastor, the leader, whoever is with you on the group, if the right setup is with that, usually you do a daily devotional, mm-hmm. and just talk about how the day went, and it's just really important, it's real, and it just leaves a very strong impact, and I definitely agree with that. You don't really ever remember a single time you went to church, but something like this, out of context, and then really putting God in front of you and reality, mm-hmm. and trying to serve, usually projects. We always did some kind of serving project, even for the students or the kids who aren't really into that. I think it touches everyone in some aspect of their life. So mm-hmm. very important. Mm-hmm.
I think piggybacking on that is even a more basic tenet in volunteer, and that's that those of us in education know you learn the best when you involve the most of your senses, and that's why a lecture is the least effective method, even though it's used so extensively in helping people of any age to learn. Mm-hmm. And I think what we're saying here is that when you can involve students in something that uses all of their senses, they are hearing and they're seeing and they're physically working. And in some cases, you know, those of us that have traveled or been in other places, using your senses of smell and taste as well. Mm-hmm. And maybe part of that issue is that when we come back to worship, we tend to still think of it as a passive experience instead of being active. Mm-hmm. And we need to continually struggle with ways to make that more of an active process for everybody. Mm-hmm. But then it becomes more something that engages everybody, and it also produces a stronger result of a sense of being worthwhile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that point too about a lot of young people say they don't have any sense they are needed. Mm-hmm. And they have such a long education. You know, it goes on and on into the 20s. And until you get through it, you really don't need to contribute much, because you're sort of, again, on your way to becoming this full contributing member of society. But when we provide occasions for young people to really do something meaningful that does have some concrete effect, it's very powerful for them. I think that's another good point.
Yeah. I just, when I think about my own kids and nurturing their spiritual life, I think about saying yes to good examples and service projects, but the harder work for me as a parent is saying no to all, you know, the other things that sort of crowd that out. And that's a really difficult journey, I think. And I see that in the congregation I serve too. I mean, there's just so many things that clamor for our children's time and energy. Mm-hmm. And some of which we can say, you know, no, that not that much TV, not that much shopping, not mm-hmm. that much entertainment. But what about volleyball camp? And mm-hmm. what about, I mean, then it just gets to be, I think, a lot of sometimes difficulty. And I look at these parents and I say, you know, how do we be supportive of one another in the same no and the same yes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
not really.
Yeah. Yeah, and some of it, you know, people get these arguments, oh, it's not that bad for them if they watch that much TV, or it's not that bad. And we could have a big debate about that, is it that bad? But when you just think about how are you using your time,
right.
yeah. and that the statistic about 22 to 27 hours of TV a week for children under 18, just that in itself, it's okay, we could say, there are the good programs bad, how much violence do they have? But just to say, boy, there was 22 hours there where maybe we could have been doing something else.
Right.
And some people talk about the frustration so much in families today that it's so frustrating. You know, some of these books about the time bind, that they want to get away to work because it's more relaxing there. It's not so messy. It's not so complicated. And you have your nice, you know, your coworkers, and you've got your coffee break, and it's just easier. So I think part of the benefit, you think not just for young people, but just think about, maybe it makes it easier to say no to certain things if you start trying to choose activities as a family that help build a sense of identity, that help, that are fun to do together, and that you want them to do some more things as a family. And service projects is a great way to begin. Some people, some psychologists almost like prescribe it. Mm-hmm. You know, you really need to do something because your family doesn't have any connection here, and you're not going to get very far just talking over and over again how bad you feel. So what you need to do is get out there and do something, because we all know, just by common sense, even helping people, you kind of get out of yourself. You see, hey, maybe it's not so bad here. Looks a little worse over here. You know, those are sort of common sense things about why helping others has always been almost kind of therapeutic, because it helps you get out of yourself and self-centered, and I think the same is true for families. But some of these studies talk about the benefit they have for also just creating family identity. What kind of family are we? And then that might help say no to some things, that yeah, we like to do that. We're a family that's engaged in sports, but we also are a family that like to do this together, and this is meaningful to us as a family.
Marcia, one of the age points for children that concerns me is that at the late primary school, you've got grade school, mm-hmm. primary school, and early high school, I love your idea about the notion of families doing service projects. I hadn't sort of conceptualized it that way. I guess in our household, there's a lot of talk about social justice and oppression mm-hmm. and those kinds of things. And how you balance that out against these very young, vulnerable people having a sense of hope in life. Because, you know, the news and a lot of discussions about school must help people get to a, you know, looking at sort of the evil side of life, why people are in these oppressed states and that they do need help. But that age group, I think, also needs to have hope and optimism.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a real, often I find we have to sort of check ourselves to say, you know, are we talking, having enough positive conversations or talking about hope, you know, and there's a double-edged sword there.
Especially after September 11th.
Oh, yes, I'd imagine that would be really so. It was in Australia, but much more so.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to add to that, yeah, we found that it was kind of ironic that our children started to become a little bit racist. And, you know, here we are in migrant ministry, and I think a lot of it was because they saw the Mexican population or the Latinos that we work with as ones that always have problems, you know, and so, like you're saying, mm-hmm. you know, we need to sort of talk about the positive side of ministry, and so, because they were seeing that Mexican folks is taking away our mm-hmm. feeling resentful of the fact that we have, you know, folks living in our house a lot of the time, or
or if you show up at any time of the day or night, knock on the door when you're in the middle of doing something as a family, mm-hmm. and realizing that, you know, when do you draw a boundary around your family as a unit? I mean, it still is difficult for us to know, you know, how you do that, because, I mean, our kids were crying out to their mom and dad, we need your time. And there were times when they would like to have, you know, these folks living with us and being with us and doing stuff, but other times they felt confused. And like my daughter would say, well, is that person in our family because they've been living with us so long? Or what is their relationship to us? And it kind of became confusing. And I mean, in a way, I guess that's fine because, like you were saying, you know, we're kind of more of an extended family to think about as Christians. You know, mm-hmm. It's not just us for ourselves. On the other hand, they were crying out for a need to know that that there was some kind of priority that they had in our lives. But they were seeing that the oftentimes our ministry was kind of coming in on that, and that they lose the prime time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, and we didn't want to get them turned off to ministry and reaching it out. And so that's been our struggle. And I don't know what the answer is to that.
Even but even the kind of language that we use to talk, you know, in our own conversations, and you think that the children aren't listening, or we've only had one at home in recent years, and you think she isn't listening, and then you sort of later on realize she has been, and we haven't talked about positive things, we're constantly talking about, oh, this is going
negative,
that problem, better do this, and better do the other.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree, it's great to have a family service project, so I'm just sort of trying, how do you get it so that there's a balance of the two?
Mm-hmm.
I think perhaps college students, like you work with, have got the maturity to be able to, you know, see it through
yeah.
an autonomy, and but it's
this younger age.
Yes, that yeah. sort of between, I guess, 11 and 15, that age group, it seems to be becoming more and more vulnerable when you look at what's happening with them.
Yeah. And they certainly, you know, you don't want to ignore the needs of your own children.
Yeah.
And how I think it's interesting to think about sometimes your own children as neighbors and strangers.
Yeah.
You don't, you know,
strangers,
strangers, yeah. and neighbors, and that they are you addressing mm-hmm. enough their needs.
I remember one of my sons saying, "Mom, I'm not connected. Can you listen anymore?"
Did people hear that?
Say it again.
She said, "Mom, if I were a Mexican, I think you'd listen to me more." Because they had so many.
You know what? I've had that too as a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Both my husband and I are teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what about us?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly.
That's kind of a true reality, really.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, more and more colleges are doing a service learning component. And I think that's a great opportunity, but I heard a message last night talking about the changing the bowl to the giving bowl.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that message because I think the service projects teach us that we can do things for each other, we can share our talents and our time, but obviously being a fundraiser, you would expect me to say something about also giving the money. And I think that's a great opportunity that she shared in the message last night during the worship service, that, you know, there's a nice opportunity to, as a family,
mm-hmm.
say, here's some extra money. We're eating because we have the opportunity to share. We have warmth, we have shelter, we have food, but let's put some money here for others, and not only who can't eat, but whatever else. I think teaching philanthropy is not only doing, but also giving resources.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think families mm-hmm. can really take an opportunity to do that. There's some good programs out there to teach that, but I think part of it is just giving ourselves, as well as making sure the kids understand what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Giving to church, giving
yeah.
to the organizations we're interested in, the colleges,
mm-hmm.
whatever that we're supporting. So the other thing I was gonna say is you mentioned something about the heroes that people have. And I think there's so much misguided hero worshiping out there. I mean, you think of the people that are out there and making some incredible sums of money that I can't even fathom,
mm-hmm.
that are the sports heroes, most of them. I mean, seems to be that sometimes there's entertainers that are part of that, but you know, the folks that are on the fronts of magazines, teen magazines, or whatever it happens to be, and they're featured in the news, and you know, how many times can you see Britney Spears or Tiger Woods or Ichiro or whatever the guy's name is that plays for the Mariners? I mean, kids look up to them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what are they doing?
Right.
Some of them are very responsible, and some of them are very great in their outreach, but mm-hmm. you know, it's probably minimal compared mm-hmm. to what they could do. But others, I remember Charles Barkley all the time that he said, I'm not a hero. You know, he was very public about that. I'm mm-hmm. no kid's hero. Don't look at me as a hero.
Mm-hmm.
And he would do really pretty stupid things. And, you know, that was his excuse. Is, I'm not a hero. Hey, no, don't look at me.
Well, I think you raised a couple important points. Like, one about money, just to talk about, maybe we could talk about that just for a little bit, because that is important. You know, the amount of money young people have at their disposal is just amazing. And, you know, you're going to be talking, aren't you, about consumer children and just how we view children as consumers and the whole industry mm-hmm. built around that.
Absolutely.
And people aren't talking mm-hmm. to children about money. And there was all these workshops now going on, people paying money to go in there to talk to people about how they should talk with their children about money, because they aren't talking about money. And I do see this in my college students who end up having tremendous credit card debts going out of college.
They average credit card debt of college students today is just under $4,000.
Mm-hmm.
That's unrestricted credit card debt.
It's now the leading cause of college dropouts.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, isn't that something?
That's not even college loans. That's mm-hmm. just this 20
credit card debt is the leading yeah. cause of college dropouts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we had this one very wonderful talk, and was involved with that, about with some pastors, and some of the pastors were saying, families too, it's kind of an unspoken secret within families, that why can't they cut back on work and be with their children more? Why are they in this time bind? It's not just the time bind, it's a money bind with very affluent families who have gotten into tremendous credit card debt. It's very embarrassing, but they can't quit their jobs and cut back because they got to pay off these debts. So that's something, I think that's a very good point, to being very open. We had, when our son was growing up, we saw it today, a really neat little bank you can get that has, it has a little slot that's mm-hmm. green, one yellow, one red. And we made the green 10% to give to the poor. It's go money, go. We spend it, we ship it out. The yellow money is, hey, be cautious. This is some money you can spend, but you have to be very cautious with this money. What are you gonna have to think about how you're gonna use that money? And then the red one is, don't ever spend it, it's for your investment. So we always put some percentage into the investment box. That was a really helpful tool just to start talking about. That's what we do, you gotta put some aside and talk more openly about how are we spending our money.
So could they, have an allowance where they themselves would put it in that slot or those slots?
Well, our family is torn about the allowance thing.
Aren't we all?
We are. We're certainly very clear about gift money from grandparents, aunts and uncles. That, hey, the percentages go in there when you get that money. And he feels very comfortable about that. We always go back and forth. Sometimes we have allowance. Sometimes, no, we shouldn't have allowance. These are just chores that we're doing. But people talk about allowance can be helpful, too, because it helps young people budget their money. Mm-hmm. They see if they wasted the money, hey, it's gone. And you got to save some more now. So I don't know if people got that figured out. Did we get the allowance thing?
No, not at all. No, I think it's hard because, you know, no one pays me to do the dishes.
Right.
Although I get money, and, you know, my husband and I, we share that money. So we've kind of figured out a way of talking about it. It's not like you're earning your allowances. It's that if you're old enough to show that you're participating as a thinking, caring member of our family, then you can also share the money as soon as you can show that.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, just like I had allowance growing up, but it wasn't, it was more like we all had chores and we had a list of chores, but I think it's a combination of both, like my parents told me, you know, the chores need to be done, but at the same time, they were teaching me like how to save and spend my money, and I've just really like learned a lot about money from them. I'm very grateful mm-hmm. them about that because I haven't had to struggle mm-hmm. with that. And I see all my friends around me that have. So I think it's necessary to have that so that you can learn, because otherwise you just hear about it and you're not actually doing it. Mm-hmm. And then they would also like tell me to be cautious with what I spent it on. Do mm-hmm. you need that or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think just the openness of just talking about it, or having that physical bowl there, something physical to help, you know, generate the discussion, that's very positive that at least there was some discussion about it. Part of sometimes it's a secret because parents haven't dealt themselves very well with the money.
I think that one of the things that has happened, and with our kids and this credit card debt thing, is that we've raised the children maybe without the allowance, yeah, or maybe they've got a job and they've just been able to, you know, 16 up and they've been able to spend the money as, I mean, well, it's my money, mm-hmm. and spend it and so forth. And if it's any big issue, it goes on the parent's credit card or the parent makes the decision. So the kids don't really, really see that money. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, they go to college and they've got these credit card bill coming at them. I'm hoping at this point we finally have gotten to the point where we've got the credit card companies not doing that. I don't know. When I was in college, they gave away free cigarettes, mm-hmm. you know, to all the fraternity houses and sorority houses, and now they're giving away free credit cards. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that same kind of thing. And they're given this, and all of a sudden, they don't know what to do with it. It's a piece of plastic. They don't realize that plastic is dollars. Mm-hmm. Because they've never had that experience. They've just never. So I think we're doing our children a very terrible disservice mm-hmm. by not doing mm-hmm. so much to church yeah. and may whether it be doing an allowance or whether you take away their paycheck and say mm-hmm. or you know or make them understand when they get a job, okay, you get a job, you're gonna make $50 a week, this is where it's gonna go. Or you can save it for some special something or another. Mm-hmm. But if you don't train them, and at 18 they're given, and at age 18 you can't do anything with them anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're the age of majority. And you can't do, I mean, you're not even entitled to their medical records or to their school records unless they choose mm-hmm. to share them with you. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's,
yeah.
You may still be supporting them going to college, but you can't know anything about what's going on.
Well, and part of that, too, is, you know, if we don't see them as contributing anything yet till they get their job, till they're out there. Part of that is connected to what you're saying about, hey, you don't contribute to anything anyway, here's the money, you can spend the sort of any way you want, because you're not really a contributing member of society yet, but yet young people, even, you know, very young children contribute a lot to our communities. I think we can learn from them that we should foster ways that they have a stronger sense of responsibility and that they really are doing some meaningful work might help mitigate some of what you're saying. Yeah.
I don't know if I heard on NPR some financial planner talking about creating a financial game where the kids have Monopoly money and they give them a certain amount, like this, the same amount that you have as your income, your household income, and then they're given the bills.
Oh.
And then the desires that you have of what else you want to do, some vacation that you have some coming up, so that the kids really can be in on how are we going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
You pay $10 on Visa and then this, or yeah, when do you pay the mortgage?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's neat. That's neat. You know, another way, a game or that bowl, like something tangible. Mm-hmm. You're not just talking one-on-one, now we have the money talk. Are there heroes? How do you address this issue you brought up, Keith, this issue about heroes, and we've talked about good examples. Mm-hmm. How do you, on the one hand, try to talk about examples that aren't, you don't think that are held up as heroes, but you don't believe they're heroes. How do you do that with young people? And what are some of the really important models in young people's lives today that you found to be, you know, that in talking to young people, they've admired these people and you were impressed by that? Who are their heroes?
I think in terms of heroes, I think Britney Spears and, you know, Justin Timberlake are the easiest, because they're on every grocery aisle or whatever. I know in a community center that I work at, one of the activities that we were going to do is look through a magazine and go through leaders or heroes or whatever, and then talk about that, and why are they leaders, and why are they important in our lives, and whatever else. And we decided to take a community newspaper and do the same kind of thing, and they were just as energized to talk about who are their heroes within the community as they would be about talking about Britney Spears. And I think that's because the opportunity was given, rather than, you know, Britney Spears being so much more alluring. But they have many more opportunities to, you know, idolize or Britney Spears than they would about, you know, our mayor or about, you know, that volunteer coordinator or whatever.
Yeah, I think this trend we have too of keeping young people out of conversations or meetings or places where we are talking about community issues, they don't have a chance to see what's going on in their neighborhoods or who's heading the sidewalk committee in our, that's helping to build the bicycle paths and the sidewalks in our neighborhood. And just having children listening to that and seeing what kind of energy people put into those kind of projects, I think that's good to help expose them to that more.
I don't believe in heroes. I think heroes are really dangerous things. Because it's saying to me that some people count more than others. And I guess that's what I've talked about with my children, that I don't believe in heroes. To have a hero puts somebody out of the realm of being human, because they somehow a hero is perfect at everything. Whereas it's somebody you might admire something they do. But everybody is worthy, everybody is valuable. So as soon as you create heroes, you're saying somebody is worth more than others. So I really like to talk about what I admire in people that they have done with this kind of thing, but that they shouldn't have to be a hero. And I can be not a hero or the person to admire, because I'm going to make mistakes. And when I make mistakes, I'm like, gee, aren't you lucky now? You don't have to be perfect.
Yeah. As I was saying a little earlier, I think good examples do talk about their limits. And that what we call heroes, right, are good examples, but that they talk about their limits, they talk about their need for forgiveness. There's a human side to it. Because otherwise, it does look like you couldn't possibly do it anyway. So if you show the human side, it helps.
Well, I don't mind the hero thing too much, but I always try to say a hero is one thing. A hero is somebody who's using their gifts, and a woman. They're not saints.
Yeah.
They don't have this, you know, but they have some, they're role models. There can be these real role models for you. And sometimes I find it's helpful to use, to find some of those people who are sort of these traditional role models, and we don't like the entertainers and athletes, but find the ones who are really doing something, who aren't the Britney Spears. I mean, there are actresses and actors and people like that who are giving an enormous amount of their time and effort to all kinds of worthwhile projects. And I say, you know, so-and-so is like that, but it's not like one of these mindless Britney Spears things. She's really doing something. I know an actress in Hollywood who's, you know, who won't do commercials, and who in fact put all of her own money into making a video for high school kids to tell them not to be sold by these commercials and all these kind of things. And so I think those folks are good role models. They're not perfect and anything like that, but sometimes they have a little of the allure because they're a star, but they're actually doing something with the gift that they have.
Although some of the kids who can't relate to those who have allure are often feel kind of left out in a way they can't identify. That's what I like about the characters in the Bible, which I grew up thinking were heroes, some of them. But then when you really look at them, you find out, wow, it's even more than I thought. God allowed these people to remain in the Bible for reasons that I can relate to as just a normal human being. Look at, you know, Abraham and Sarah. Look at how, you know, the kind of things that they did. And God still used them, and in spite of themselves, they were able to do this because of God, you know. And that's always inspired me.
One of my friends is working in Germany on a kind of series of books telling the life story of people who made an impact that kind of show that, and young people just love reading these books, partly because it shows some of their struggles, the human side, but also that they did make an impact, and she thinks it's important to put out some people there that you do, whether you talk about it, admire them or role models, because otherwise their life is cluttered with other people. I guess I'm kind of surprised when I get my college students and they know Martin Luther King, but they don't know people like Bonhoeffer, or they don't know people like Dorothy Day. That hasn't been kind of handed down to them as people who have done something. I mean, so there's almost a vacuum there, and then it's filled in with these things that are right at hand at the newspaper stand. So these stories are very powerful. A friend of mine, too, reads biographies with his son, and he's found that really powerful, too, because then you kind of get a bigger picture than just look at that person. They're so great. But boy, they started out with some struggles, or they had some kind of handicap. They got through it, and they really were able to make an impact. I think we have to close. Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you so much for your contribution. And oh, if you want this, it's just a resource that's got some theological text, but also some text by psychologists. And it's just quite a nice list of resources on education, in the church.